It's Sunday afternoon and time once again here on Asheville FM for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. This summer brought novelist Sujatha Hampton to Asheville for readings in support of her new book, As It Was Written. Growing up as an Indian American woman has given Sujatha a rich and wonderful range of material and a unique perspective on life in this strange country, the United States, the country to which her parents moved before she was born, and on life in India, too, the country they left, if never in some ways left behind. Here's Sujatha reading at Asheville's Malaprops Bookstore.
Okay. Good evening. Nice to meet you. You know, whenever I hear people introduce me, you know, you think about, you know, different things. Like, you know, I can honestly say I'm Malayali. Malayali is, we are from Kerala, India. And people in India are vastly different from, you know, place to place, from state to state, vastly, vastly different. And people will always say to me things like, oh, your weddings are so spectacular. I went to an Indian wedding once, and it was just 7 days. It was amazing. You should see the way our weddings are. Our weddings are the most simple, dour, serious kinds of things. They're like anti-weddings. And originally, honestly, in the original way of getting married was to simply exchange cloth. And once you exchanged cloth, you were married. And so it was like the exact opposite of the 7 day wedding plus elephants, you know. And in this book, actually, like, you know, Lauren just said that there was a curse. The story of that curse, which I can tell you just really briefly so I can make my segue here, is that this old, disgusting, completely disgusting man, very old, and I didn't actually age him, but I would imagine he's something like 70 years old, decides he wants to take this woman to be not really a wife, more of a concubine. It's about 150 years ago in Kerala, you were allowed to do that. And he decides to take her for his own, and he does it by going to buy a piece of cloth to give her, and that was all that was required. Once he gave her that cloth, he could take her for his own, and he's completely disgusting. He, in fact, does do this, and that's where this curse originates, and I might read you a little bit of that curse. I don't usually read that part because I feel like, you know, the whole story is so dramatic and slow, and I always wonder whether it will captivate your interest. Perhaps it will. Somebody asked me to do that. Somebody who was here asked me to do that, so I thought I would find a part that I could read you. Anyway, I thought that I might start real quick. I'll just introduce my book, then I might read something to you, and then please let me know if there's anything in particular you want to know or hear so that I make sure that I answer any question that you have about anything. I'm happy to talk about whatever. My own journey, the journey of becoming a writer, whatever. I'm happy to talk about whatever. So this story came to me. It just came out in February. And it's a story of, I always say the elevator pitch is that it's about Dr. Raman Nair and his five fat daughters and the ancient Brahmin curse that followed them from India to the States. That's the elevator pitch. And so people say, and they'll read the book and they'll just be wondering about these. Why are they fat? Why are these? They're fat. There are five daughters. They're the daughters of this family. And they're these Malayali girls growing up where I grew up in Northern Virginia. And they are very big. And that's just the way they are. And why are they fat? I don't really exactly know why they're fat, except that I sort of know a family that's kind of like that. And it just seemed to me, I saw the book and I wrote down what I saw. So there you go. I kind of saw the book. I can honestly say this book was truly channeled. I have absolutely no idea. I didn't do any thinking. It just arrived. There it was. You know, it just arrived. I started typing and there it was every day. It was just, but they are these spectacular people. This family is spectacular and wonderful and beautiful and big and boisterous, and they have a giant great Dane named Taj Mahal, and they just love each other so much, and they're just wonderful people, and yet tragedy befalls all over the place, and joy too, but as life does, it unfolds the way life does, and good and the bad happen. But these people, when you read them and you just love them so much, and when terrible things happen to them, your heart is like, oh, they're so nice, why would that happen to such nice people? And yet it does all the time. Anyway, I'm going to read just a little bit so you know who I'm talking about. They entered his life, one just after the other, like perfectly flowing lines of verse. Nina, Meera, Usha, Dhanya, and Shanti, aged 26, 24, 22, 17, and 15, because there was nothing he loved more than the sight of his beloved wife pregnant, with one in her arms and another wrapped around her leg. Her long, black, lush, wavy hair was ever so much longer, blacker, lusher, and wavier when she was carrying one of these gorgeous girls. Only girls could make a beautiful woman even more beautiful, or so the wives' tale told. It was certainly so in Jaya Nair's case. The five daughters of Dr. Raman Nair were legendary in their domestic abilities, in their precocious talents, in their gracious temperaments, and, of course, in their prodigious size. Never had a family of American-born Indian girls been given the same careful guidance with regard to traditional cooking, from shopping for the ingredients to preparation of the vegetables to grinding of the spices with a mortar and pestle. If they were together, they could prepare an entire sadhya themselves without the assistance of their mother. For this alone, they were held in high regard by all the friends and colleagues of Dr. Raman Nair. He looked at them always with great pride. Then, these same girls could sing, they could dance, they each played the piano, they studied other things, they liked to study things, they learned things quickly and used the things they learned to learn other things, like learning violin because they played the piano or learning Italian because they knew French. They taught each other the things they learned, and sometimes Dr. Raman Nair would peep into the room of his youngest daughter, Shanti, to catch her leaned against the shoulder of his oldest daughter, Veena, watching her Chechi finish a complicated stitch in a hand-knit sweater that later they would present him as a surprise for no reason at all, though it was summer, because the yarn was on sale then, and they were, in addition to all their other qualities, frugal as well. The beautiful daughters of Dr. Raman Nair laughed all the time, and when the doorbell rang, they all went running along with Taj the dog because they were similarly eager to have one more person around, or three, or four, and if there were four, they would immediately call it a party and begin to cook and laugh and pull out the photo albums that showed the pictures of the last time these four people came to visit, or the first time these people came to visit, and they would feed them with great care, and one would be standing beside to refill the glasses, and another would heap in a bit more fish or rice or small spoonfuls of mango pickle, and they would chatter just right about current events or funny stories and ask just the right number of questions about just the right subjects with just the right level of curiosity without nosiness. And when these four people left, they would get into their car and sigh and say to each other, "I can't wait until the next time they throw a party," even if there had never been a party, but simply some saris to pick up or some check to drop off or simply stopping by because they were in the neighborhood. Dr. Raman Nair would close the door behind the company and turn back into his house, glowing with great pride. Everyone in the world loved the daughters of Dr. Raman Nair, and perhaps it was because of this that their enormous, gigantic, astounding size made so little difference to them. They did not seem to be bothered that together they could barely fit in Veena's adorable Audi. When they all took a deep breath and inserted themselves, cushioned against each other, and certain that the steel frame of the car would hold them in place until they reached their destination, they didn't even mention the discomfort. And because they could each sew, they looked spectacular always. Their clothes fit to perfection, and their hair was so remarkably lustrous and thick, and their faces were, every one of them, absolutely breathtaking, so that really, between their irresistible personalities, or sensational clothes, or super shiny, extra glossy, curly, or wavy, or mirror straight hair, they turned heads everywhere they went. And because they were so happy and so bright and so accomplished and so beloved, the five fat daughters of Dr. Raman Nair had healthy self-esteem and no body issues. And because they had healthy self-esteem and no body issues, they were accustomed to their fair share of attention from men, though they really didn't pay much heed, because nothing is more attractive in the long run than a woman who feels she is beautiful, even if she never bothers to think about it at all. And beyond that, the five fat daughters of Dr. Raman Nair were endowed with the largest, juiciest, roundest, and most irresistible pairs of breasts ever seen in the universe. And the five pairs of breasts of Dr. Raman Nair's daughters were a never-ending source of distress among hotel porters, taxi drivers, shoe salesmen, and the diminutive clerks at the India store, who were often forced to share small spaces with these five girls and their 10 breasts, crammed in tight, leaning forward, squeezed together. Every once in a while, one of these men would whimper aloud from the strain of reining in his hand and mouth. He would turn in his lips, and his eyes would tear up, and then he would utter a pitiful whimper and drop his gaze in shame. being the girls that they were, when this happened, they all gathered in closer to assure he was okay. They felt his head, they held his hands, and they looked deeply into his eyes with theirs, long-lashed and limpid. Every once in a while, one of the whimpering men thus fainted into their formidable chests, never to know he had been there. When this happened, the girls would lower him gently to the ground. They would loosen his shirt and massage his chest. And once in a while, Veena, Meera, Usha, Tanya, or once even Shanti would have to give him CPR. And when the poor man awoke, he would be told by his co-workers that he had been laid down, undressed, massaged, and essentially kissed by one of the five fat daughters of Dr. Raman Nair while the others encircled him on their knees, bent forward with concern, hands resting on his thighs or abdomen. And when he realized he had slept through it all, he would curse his weak constitution and wish he had had the talent to have faked the whole thing. So that's the girls I'm talking about. They are... like delightful like that, you know, and they're delicious like that, and they're delightful like that, and they just love each other so much, and then all this stuff happens to them in the story that, you know, you would hope doesn't happen, which all of our parents hoped that wouldn't happen. I think that all of our Indian parents, when they came here with such high hopes and everything, really did think that somehow or other they could retain the best of home and get the best of here and everything would be fantastic. And it really just never works out like that, ever, 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 ever. And it usually comes with a lot of lying. We all like wake up in the morning lying, and we lie all day, and then we go to bed and we are quiet while we sleep, and we wake up in the morning lying, and we do that for many, many, many years. You know, that's sort of the way it goes. And so it's sort of the story of them. Would you like me to read you more, or would you like to ask me questions, or what? Yes? More reading? I don't want to bore you to death. Just tell me when it's enough and you have questions for me. Let me see. So it's the story of these people, okay, the story of this family. So let me just tell you. This is just so you know who I'm reading about. It's the story of this family, of this Indian family and their girls, and the father, Dr. Raman Nair, you heard me read about him, he has a sister as well, and his sister is embroiled in a love affair with a married man, which, you know, she didn't mean to be in a love affair with a married man. It happens, things like that happen, so it happened, and she was quite young when she started this love affair. And so it's the story of these girls, of the sister, Geeta, and her love affair with her American lover, and the story of what, and the curse story as well. So there's this curse, and this sister is writing the curse. She's writing the story of the curse as a novel. She's a novelist, and she's a professor. She works at the University, George Washington University, and she's a professor. And she's writing the story of this man. I think I might read to you a little bit of that, something I didn't read. And just so you know, he is the old man I was telling you about. He's completely disgusting. He's very old, and he sweats too much, and he always is chewing pan. You know what pan is? He's chewing that when it dribbles red out of his mouth, and he's disgusting. He's skinny and gross, and he has decided that he's going to take this girl as his concubine. She's very young, and she has just now left her home in the early dawn to go bathe in the temple pool, which is the way that they used to, they still do that sometimes in some places back home in Kerala. They have a temple, and the temple has what they call a kolam, and kolam is a pool, and you can bathe there, and they have a men's section, and they have a women's section, and they're not near one another. And generally speaking, this is never a problem. It's not like people are going and peeking at women or anything like that. That just tends not to be the case. And nowadays, a lot of people have their own, they bathe in their home. But in the old days, people used to do that. And in the very old days, everybody used to do that. You know, if you had a temple, that's where you went to bathe. And you would pray also, and you would bathe. So she has just come to bathe. And before bathing, she did not pray or anything. She was going to pray after she bathed, as you always pray after you bathe. So she's gone in, you go behind the temple, you climb down the steps, you go down the steps, and there's the pool. And Parameshwaran Nambudri is this disgusting man's name, and he is watching her bathe here. So he has not yet asked for her to come. He's not yet taken her. he's going to take her. He's preparing to take her, and he's watching her now. And her name is Omana Kumari. And the story is called The Cursed Life of Srimati Omana Kumari. Parameshwara Nambudri was already clean, and he entered the temple and prayed quickly with his forehead to the damp floor. Rising, he dipped his thumb in the sandalwood paste and drew a cool slick up his brow in a long stripe. The cold of the paste focused his coursing power in the inner corners of his eyes, increasing their acuity. His brain was much invigorated for the task of wooing and immediate desire of watching a girl bathe. Outside, behind a wooden pillar carved with phalluses and grateful women, Parameshwara Nambudri took his position. Down in the green pool, Omana Kumari was alone. Her back was to him, and her hair was loosed and blue-black over her shoulders. Parameshwara Nambudri drew passion from her glowing shoulders. He was certain she would be his very soon. His study of her back was minute. How closely must one watch to catch the lengthening of shadows, to note the elongation of the arms between noon and twilight? How acutely aware would a man be if he noted that micro moment when the torso grew the tiniest bit? How much worth must be ascribed to that shadow to measure its change? It was with this searing focus that Parameshwara Nambudri noticed how Omana Kumari's hair was curling up her back, and that as it dried, it pulled upward and upward in a languorous seduction that nearly drove him down the steps and into the water beside her. With each passing moment, a lock sprang away from her skin, breaking from its sister hairs and beginning its passage up toward her shoulders and her neck and her fine bone jaw that receded to her ears like perfectly pieced parts. Parameshwara Nambudri moved slightly into the open to see her better as she leaned forward to splash her face again, and the sight of her dripping made him shudder. He reached for cover and hid again. Turning his back, he leaned on the column and faced the temple. He closed his eyes and fought to control his heart, which was thudding and emptying his chest of air. The full resources of his lungs were expended in the simple act of staying alive in light of this bathing girl, and he imagined that all he needed to be happy forever was her curling hair spread across a pillow and her naked breasts in his mouth. Peeking around the pillar, he saw that she had emerged from the pool and was dressing, removing her towels as she went. She took one tendril of hair and gently wrapped the rest with it, securing it slightly so it would not hang in her face as it dried. She looked back toward the water and threw something. Parameshwara Nambudri wondered what it was, because she was fascinating in her every movement. He wondered if she smelled like fresh milk. He imagined that it might be so. Walking back into the temple, he stood in the dark and waited for her to come. Omana Kumari, softly climbing the steps to the temple, was thinking that she was hungry and that she would pray and hurry home and eat. This thought made her climb faster, and when she entered the temple, she was smiling. The wet hair around her temples was curled in wisps that looked like thinking, rather like dreaming. Parameshwara Nambudri felt that he might rise off the ground on her cloud of purity and happiness so large that it filled the temple and made the gods wonder who of their rank must have just entered. It seemed to Parameshwara Nambudri that he had been waiting an eternity for her. It seemed to him that this morning's stalking had gone on for days rather than perhaps the half an hour of pursuit in which he had actually engaged. He was tired. His head was light. His shoulders were aching. His patience had been admirable. And the moment he had imagined at least all this day, and certainly portions of other days as well, for at least 1 year and maybe even longer than that, that moment had arrived. He was long ready. Parameshwara Nambudri stepped into a stripe of light painted along the ground and stood there, arms at his sides, towel draped over his shoulders. His hair was tied in a knot, and his chest was bare. He had the dwindled frame of an old man with a large paunch like an umbrella, and he was smiling. Omana Kumari jumped back with a gasp and a squeal, and she dropped her cloth but didn't dare retrieve it. His teeth were pointed, and his tongue was squeezed between them like an udder. He had drawn back his lips in a smile that exposed his gums, swollen and red. All her fear was centered in the look of his mouth. The cloud of joy that had changed the air when she entered just as quickly dissipated, and sudden dankness made Parameshwara Nambudri reach for his towel and mop his face. She backed toward the temple door, and Parameshwara Nambudri followed her slowly, staying in the column of light. The illumination of him did nothing to improve his aspect. In the light, he appeared like a hairy thing that had been shaved, too pink, too raw, unnaturally naked. Omanakumari stepped backward over the threshold. He noted that there was the smallest gathering of fat about her middle as she raised her leg. As she stood in the light outside the door, he noticed that, nonetheless, her waist was no larger around than the circle of his fingers and thumbs. "Are you not Omanakumari from Chandro, the daughter of Anandan Nambiar?" "Yes." "You're so big now. Such a big girl. I remember when you were so small." Parameshwaran's Nambudri's voice was full of spittle. He cleared his throat, turned his head, and spat. He coughed slightly and exhaled in satisfaction. Omanakumari looked down and drew her toes in toward her ankles. She stepped one foot on top of the other. She pulled her chin into her chest. She drew hair from behind her to cover her body and then clenched her hands tight. She held her clenched hands over her chest and shut her eyes. She receded until there was nothing left that moved. Parameshwaran Nambudri stepped boldly toward her and took hold of her hair between a finger and thumb. She turned her throbbing head slightly away. Her wet hair slid between his fingers. Parameshwaran Nambudri was enchanted by her reluctance. He was delighted by her modesty. He twisted his fingers around the lock of her hair and with the same hand reached for her chin. He turned her head toward him and looked at her face. Her clenched eyes were brimming and her lips were pursed so tightly the tiny lines were drawn in her baby skin. Omanakumari was not breathing because she could feel his heart so close. She could feel his heat so close and she dared not open her eyes. Parameshwaran Nambudri let go of her chin and unwrapped her hair from his fingers. He stood back one step. Omanakumari stood with her hands clenched to her chest, with her hair over her body, with her toes drawn in, one foot atop the other. She remained tucked tight, with her eyes closed, barely breathing. Her tears flowed like a rill between her fingers, trickling down her wrists. Parameshwaran Nambudri watched for a minute longer. He drew his towel over his chest and his arms, which were sweating profusely. Looking at Omanakumari trembling before him, he was unnerved by the intrusive realization that to this child he looked loose and gray, that he was spotted and yellow, that she would be repulsed by him, that she had not a single desire for him, though he was overturned and hypnotized by the thought of her. He found that his tenderness was suddenly roiled with resentment. He looked at her, still standing there with her eyes clamped shut, and realized that she didn't open them because he revolted her. Parameshwaran Nambudri turned back toward the temple and stepped inside. "Eh, Omanakumari!" Omanakumari was silent and did not move at all, but for the thorough trembling. "I say, Omanakumari, do you hear me?" She replied, as she heard the dangerous insistence in his voice. "I will be coming." With this, Parameshwaran Nambudri turned his back on the trembling girl and walked away. Soon after, Omanakumari left the temple, but as it was, she forgot to pray, and it seems that God never forgave her. That's that. That's sort of the beginning of that. It does not go well for them. Yeah, he's really gross. He was a grotesque character to write. And honestly say that when you had to write him that you felt like slightly sick to your stomach. And they made him completely disgusting. He really is always sweating and always dripping pan beetle juice down his face. And he's always completely awful. And I did that because she makes a very, very, very difficult, very bold and terrible choice. That she and we as people, readers, have to be able to sympathize with why she chooses to do what she does, why anybody would choose to do what she did. And in order to do that, I mean, that's one of those artist decisions, those writer's decisions, like, because people will say, "Oh, he's so horrible that you have to do that. Oh, I felt sick every time I read him. I couldn't read him if I was going to eat." You know, like people, strangers will write you, it's like, "I couldn't even, he was so just disgusting, disgusting." Well, you know, he really had to be. And you don't even know when you're reading a book, I think. I never stopped to think about it until I was writing a book, but when you're reading a book, you don't even understand what the artist has done to make you sympathize with, and make you understand and why that would have to happen. Yeah.
You're listening to Wordplay on Asheville FM. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Today we're celebrating the verse novel of Indian American writer Sujatha Hampton. The day after her reading at Malaprops, I was able to talk Sujatha into sitting down for an interview here at Asheville FM. So let's listen to some of that interview. How did you come to write this wonderful novel of yours?
Well, how I came to write this novel, I can't necessarily say. I don't know. Maybe I can come up with it if I start
others.
Talking.
There were others?
No, there were no others. No. This is my first novel.
Yeah.
But it's the only thing I ever wanted to do. Being a novelist is the only thing I ever wanted to do. So how this story came to me.
Though you actually came to writing then later in
life. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I had a whole career. I'm an educator. I was a teacher.
Uh-huh.
I was on the faculty at the University of Virginia. I was an educational administrator.
Huh.
And I can't say I did not enjoy that. I did enjoy that work very much. I thought it was important work, and I enjoyed it. But truly, the only thing I have ever wanted to do since I was 7 years old was to be a novelist. So it took a while to get the courage to do that. Actually, that's really what it is.
So you didn't go through writing programs and all the usual.
I never even taken a class. So, you know, it's a miracle. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do and truly did not even have the courage to say that out loud too much until I was very grown, full career, and I didn't have the courage to write the first word of anything until I defended my doctoral dissertation.
Oh, right. You mentioned that at Marshall, right?
Yeah. I just didn't want anyone to think that I was just a big, giant failure.
Or a slacker, or just one more person,
with some kind of goofy, stupid pipe dream. I mean, you know, I really talked myself out of a lot of courage.
Sure.
And I come from very hardworking, conservative kind of people, and I just didn't want to make everybody feel like I was a big joke and a disappointment, I think. Uh-huh. So that's why I had to get really educated so I could feel like I cannot do anything more. I have gone as educated as I can get, and now you can't say that I'm a slacker.
Yeah,
you really
she never amounted to anything.
Again, she never amounted to anything. I try to forgive myself for having been so easily awed.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you were married. You had children.
I have children.
I mean, so it's one wants not to be a slacker when one is.
Well, it wasn't that. It was that I needed to have all of that first, so no one could be nagging me to say, you didn't do this, or why don't you, when are you going to do this, when are you going to do that? And
you fulfilled all your
I fulfilled
your
all of my obligations. Really what it is, that's exactly what it
is.
I mean, Indian people are very dutiful people and very much, very, very much influenced by what our parents and families think of us. And at least I shouldn't speak for all Indian people.
Right.
At least I felt that way. Malayali people tend to be that way. Malayali people are the people from Kerala.
Uh-huh.
They tend to be that way.
Which is a southwestern India.
A southwestern state in India. It's a very highly educated place. And people there tend to be very conservative, to take education very seriously, to be very family-oriented. And the people the Malayalis who come to the States are like the cream of the crop, so to speak. I mean, they're the most educated. They've done the most. And so I came from that stock. My parents are part of the original, what they call the brain drain of India in the late 60s.
Yeah.
Many, many educated people
left
India because there was little work there comparatively, and they came to the West. And my parents represent that group, and they came here and had their children here. So I was born in the States.
Yeah.
But still, you're born with this heavy ethic that you have to keep up with.
Achieve. And
you have to achieve.
Yeah.
And I already always felt like I was such a black sheep, so to speak, because, I had absolutely no interest in studying medicine and really very little interest in any kind of engineering type, science type work. And I studied language when I was in college, which really, is essentially useless, is what people will think.
You
have all these useless endeavors.
We joke about English majors.
Exactly. So I really did that to myself. And now when you're an adult and you look back on your life and you think, gosh, why was I so afraid of what people thought? But I was. It's easy to say when you actually have achieve something. But truly, you know, that's the journey. That's my journey. So I can't, I can't have had another one. This is the way it is. So it's regret is futile. So I might as well just, I might as well just accept this is the journey I have. This is how I got here. Yeah. And I'm just really thankful that I dared to do it, and I'm really, really grateful that it worked.
It turned out well.
It turned out well. Thank God. Right. I don't exactly know how that happened, but it did. So,
well, this is it's such a formally inventive novel. When you read it, it seems like such a straightforward and wonderful story, but when you actually explore the book, it's got a novel within a novel. It's got a journal within the novel. It's got all manner of other little features. Who are your models when you undertook to write this?
This is going to sound like I always wonder whether Mark Halperin one day will hear how often I talk about him and wonder when he reads my book what I'm talking about. But I read Mark Halperin's Winter's Tale. Uh-huh. I don't know if you've ever read it.
I have not read it.
It is a wonderful novel. Uh-huh. And he is a masterful, wonderful writer. Uh-huh. And that particular book, he's a genius in all respects. But that particular book, Mark Halperin's Winter's Tale, was given to me as a gift and changed my life, because I think before I read that book, now mind you, again, as I said, I have never taken a course or didn't have any writer friends. I never talked to anybody who was writing or anything. I just went off to do this, right? And I think that until I read that book, I was really writing with what I call the gloves on. Uh-huh. I just had my gloves on and I was ready, and everything was very safe.
Right.
I come from very conservative people, though I myself am not a remotely conservative person, and I have made dreadful mistakes in my life and had, you know, all kinds of adventures of various levels of danger, you know.
Uh-huh.
I still am my parents' daughter, and I was really scared. You think, oh my gosh, people are going to read this. Oh, everybody's going to read this. That kind of, you feel a little bit worried when you start doing this. And maybe other people explore. Yeah, exactly. And maybe other people explore those things earlier on. But I was, like as I said, I started doing this later in my life. I already had a full career. So I had to work through that myself. And a friend of mine gave me Winter's Tale, which changed my life, because he writes in that book, it seems like just anything he wanted to do, he just went ahead and said, yeah, okay, we're going to do that too. And just, it's extraordinary. The quality of the writing is masterful, and that's what's required. You can do a lot of crazy, zany things when you are a genius of a writer, right?
Sure.
So he did, I mean, the story is completely audacious. It's off the chain, you know, it's just off the chain. And I was like, well, you know what, if he can do that, and they published his book, then I'm going to do that too. I don't see why I can't, you know? And that was the beginning of taking the leash off myself, taking the gloves off, and then just going for it.
Yeah.
So if something occurred to me that I wanted to write, something, any old kind of tangent, just anything that came to my mind, I went ahead and did it. And I always wonder whether he will ever hear that I always say that he was such a great influence on my work, because if you read this book now, it does not read with that same kind of audacity.
Uh-huh.
It's not the same kind of audacious book, because it's very hard for a debut novelist in this current publishing market to do things that are completely off the wall like that.
Right.
You have to have a readership, and I think that they were more willing to take that kind of risk on the American public, on the American reading public, several decades ago than they are now.
Yeah, right.
And so I always wonder if he's going to read this book and be like, what is she talking about exactly? But still, some of those elements remain, because they were there to begin with. When I finished this book, it was twice as long.
Oh, really? Really? Okay.
Literally.
Yeah.
Literally
yeah.
twice as long. And my agent, bless her heart, read the first 200 pages or something. It was like, you know, nearly 800 pages. She read the first 200 pages and told me, I want to work with you, and we're going to need to cut your book in half. Well, you know, when you first start doing this, you don't know how you're going to do it, and you aren't sure that you can, and you think every word in there is just precious and beautiful and fantastic, and how could you get rid of this, and how could you get rid of that? But when you started with a book that was quite ambitious and bold and audacious, you don't lose that, you know? And so I think that is how it has a flavor, that it is something spectacularly extravagant, you know? Even though it is only a 370-page book, it's a totally average-length book now. But that flavor is there. So that was, I think, the greatest influence on my actual writing. But I read beautiful things, and I only read beautiful things. That's the truth. I have two children. I had a full-time job. I do not I do not anymore. Now I write full time, but still I do not spend my time reading things that are not spectacularly beautiful. Yeah. So I honestly think that Marilynne Robinson was an enormous influence on me because she seems to craft just one beautiful sentence after another, as does John Banville. However, John Banville, I discovered after I finished my book, so I cannot credit him, let's say, with the beautiful sentences, the courage to write beautiful sentences. Uh-huh. Marilynne Robinson writes beautiful sentences that render you speechless, uh-huh. and I really very much want to write beautiful sentences. So, uh-huh. You know, that's, I think, part of the lyrical quality of the book is uh-huh. that it is.
It does have a music to it.
Thank you very much. Yes, that there's that. But I, at the same time, you know, like I loved Oscar Wilde, you know, The Brief Undress Life of Oscar Wilde, but I can't say at all that I was necessarily influenced by Diaz. My writing. Yeah. He has such an edginess. But Dominican people and Indian people is a very different kind of people. I mean, yeah. you know, I don't have an edgy life, and my people aren't edgy people in right. that way. I mean, I know they're there. Indians have got an edginess, yeah. but I'm not from that. So I'm not right. from that culture. It rings untrue. Yeah. So even though I love the way he writes, I cannot necessarily mimic that whole way he has of that beautiful punchiness to his language. That it's just not me, though. Yeah. I read so many beautiful things. I can honestly say this, Jeff. I am deeply, deeply influenced by everything there is to be influenced that I read. So yeah. when I read to steal. Uh-huh. You know, I do. I am stealing shamelessly stealing. And it's, you know, when I say that, I mean with all due respect sure. to everyone that I read, I am reading and I am absorbing every single wonderful, fabulous thing that there is there. And if it is possible for me, I will use it. Yeah. Okay, if yeah. I can. If I can envelop that into my arsenal of yeah. of abilities, I yeah. do. And I'm always willing, happy to credit just everyone who has.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I just recently, a few months ago, finished Olive Kitteridge. They won the Pulitzer Prize last year, right? And there's something about that moved me to want to even try to write short stories. I'm not really, in general, moved by short stories. But that whole short story as novel, because that's not short stories. It is a novel, but it's short stories as novel. And I thought it enormously inventive. And I liked... It's word school. Every book, it's like word school. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Every book for me is like word school. Yeah. And of course, like you were asking, you were asking about Marquez, right? Yesterday you brought up Gabriel García Márquez. Right. And of course, 100 Years of Solitude is, when you have in your heart and your soul the love for that kind of, there was a time of magical realism in our, mm-hmm. just a few decades back, mm-hmm. when magical realism was very much part of our literary life, especially right. if you were reading any of the Latin writers.
Sure, right.
And this book, my book, does not have any magical realism in it, yet mm-hmm. people will say, all the time, people will say, you know how there's sort of this magical realism? There isn't. There's no magical realism in this book, yeah. and yet, I think it sort of makes you feel like there is, even though there really isn't. Yeah. You know, unequivocally there isn't.
It features a curse. It does.
Yeah, it features a curse, but the thing is that the curse is absolutely not... not written like anything that is necessarily absolutely for sure real.
Right.
It's just, you know, when right. you come from cultures that have a lot of that mysticism as part of the culture, people believe things in ways that they don't believe in the West. Yeah. They just have a sense yeah. of belief in the supernatural, and they have a sense of belief in the power of energy, the belief in the word, you say something, it happens, that kind of the evil eye. Mm-hmm. These are cultures that right. believe that.
Sure.
But it's just because of people. My book is about humanity. It's just humans and the way humans interpret things. It's really not about magic and supernatural anything. And yet, because there's a curse, even though it's never presented as anything, anything more than just something somebody said, and it's not even like the fuku. In Oscar Wilde, he talks about the fuku, which is also a curse, right? And I don't think that book either has any kind of magical realism. It's still just a curse, and you can either believe or not believe that this fuku is putting its hand down on everybody else, you know? And I think actually the way that Diaz keeps himself from falling into any kind of magical realism feel with his curse too, because I did not think that that was a book that was full of magical realism, is because there's all this historical part about right. Trujillo throughout the whole book, and because he's bringing in all this true life history,
right.
I mean, with the dates and the facts and the everything as footnotes, which is also enormously inventive, you know, he keeps it from treading over into magical realism, you know?
It's so grounded.
Yeah, it's very grounded. Yeah. Whereas, like, if you read Salman Rushdie, if you read Midnight's Children, that is a book of magical realism, of course, several decades old.
Right.
We're not allowed to do that too much nowadays. Yeah. It's that the world has changed in its taste.
Yeah,
the publishing world has changed in its taste.
Sure, right. The era of magical
realism. The era of magical realism has
faded.
It's
become something else.
So, and you need to know these things, I guess, when you write. Although this book, isn't like that anyway. So, you know.
Well, who did you read when you were, growing up as a young woman? Because obviously, it's got a deep, you know, sense of style.
I read a lot of Isabel Allende when I was in my 20s. I read a lot of Isabel Allende.
Yeah.
I love her. Especially those old ones like Casa de los Espíritus, House of the Spirits. And and all of those Eva Luna books and all. I liked a lot of that. I read a lot of A.B. Tan back then too. Uh-huh. I have noted that my taste in literature has become decidedly more snobby, I think. I don't know. It seems that way to me, that I'm reading a lot more extremely literary fiction kind of books, you know, as opposed to more more popular literary fiction or more popular fiction. Something changed in my taste as I began to write also. Which happened only very recently, really, that I...
Yeah.
It's not like I've been trying and trying and trying for years. I haven't been.
Right.
I was very lucky, you know, that it went relatively quickly for me to get published. But I have noted that what I read now... Like right now, I've gone back, I'm reading Peter Carey. Right now, I am reading the... What's it called? The Kelly Gang book. I forget the whole title. The True Life Story of the Kelly Gang. Something I don't remember. Yeah. It's by Peter Carey. It won the Booker Prize a couple of decades ago. And... it's fantastic. Peter Carey is fantastic. And I I'm reading a lot of these kind of like award-winning, kinds of books, even if they're several decades old. Because I think maybe because I have really adopted that, consciously adopted that it's for word school, that I'm reading and learning at the same time.
Right.
And so I read really great people so that I can...
Sure.
Learn really great things,
right.
And I do not. I no longer have patience for. I have very little patience now for what is determined, say popular fiction.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because there's enormously talented. Sure, there are enormously talented people writing really entertaining things.
And genre fiction, some wonderful genre fiction.
Yeah, like, and I just
mystery,
and I,
et cetera, et cetera.
And it's the problem really. And like, okay, so I just read. You just said mystery. I recently, several months ago, read. What's it called? The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
Oh, I don't know that one. Yeah.
Oh my gosh!
Good.
So great, Chabon. It's Chabon, Michael Chabon. It's so wonderful, and it's a mystery.
Yeah.
So it's a mystery, but it's a totally literary fiction mystery.
Yeah.
And he's extremely talented man, extremely talented writer. And I was enthralled. It was fantastic. And so it was like genre fiction in the sense that it is a mystery, but it's totally literary fiction. So I can really get into it. It's beautiful to read. It really, I just don't have a lot of time to. I mean, I do have these kids, and I don't have the time to read a lot the way. So.
Right.
So I really want to make sure I'm going to love what I read.
Yeah, sure. Good plan. So what are you writing now? What are you working on?
I haven't been writing for several months because I've been working on promotion for this book. I was working on a book that was, I'm a little bit superstitious to talk too much about what I'm working on right now. But it is a completely different, vastly different book than this, that is set during World War II.
Uh-huh.
In India, and it's a story of brothers at war. I was writing that. And I'm probably about a third of the way through that. And I really, there's a book that I'm dying to write right now. It's like sitting in my head.
Uh-huh.
And I was inspired by the name of a lake. I was in Oregon on book tour, and there was a lake, and I don't even want to tell you the lake because the name of the lake is so fantastic that I don't want anyone to steal it. But I was so inspired. I was driving from Bend, Oregon, to a girlfriend's house. She lives in Vancouver, Washington, and I was going to stay with her while I did that.
Oh, it's beautiful country.
Very beautiful country. Yeah. And I was driving. Yeah. It was 4 hours driving. And, of course, right. I don't listen to the music. Like I told you, I don't listen to music while I drive. Right. Even 4 hours, I'm thinking. I'm all up in my head, and I'm thinking. And there was a sign that said the name of this lake. I was like, oh, my gosh, that's such a great name.
I have to
and
use that.
Immediately, a story started coming to me just completely based on this name.
Uh-huh.
And so what I've been doing, which is lots of fun, is that as I collect, I'm collecting stories for that story, for that book. Because it started with a name. It had no real story. So it started with a name. And that name is very inspiring to me. And so things I'm collecting as I read now, things I'm collecting from other people telling me things, people that I'm collecting on the street, I collect people. Yeah. You know what I mean by that?
Sure.
Yeah, I collect
people. It's like
people
watching, but...
I do it all the time. So it's like if somebody does something, a particular thing that I think is interesting, it'll end up.
Right.
It's appropriate. I'm still as shamelessly as I'm stealing people's work, I'm stealing people's mannerisms. And there's a line in here. There's a line in this book, in As It Was Written. I said Ernest Ansel with a face like a kindly pot roast, and I was in the gym on a treadmill next to a girlfriend of mine named Leslie. And a guy came out of the locker room, and I said to her, oh my goodness, doesn't he look like a pot roast? And not everybody thinks like I do. Not everybody notices these things. And I just thought it was so clear how he looked like a pot roast. And she looked at me like I was completely crazy, you know? Like, he looks like a pot roast? What do you mean he looks like a pot roast? And, you know, I said, you know how his face is sort of shaped like this and it's kind of too red, you know? You know? But and she says, a pot roast? I said, well, you know, a nice pot roast. But a pot roast, you know? So there I was, and I got to this firefighter who's helping this woman who's stuck in a snowdrift, and his name is Ernest Ansel with a face like a kindly pot roast. So, you know, things like that.
It's a kindly pot roast.
It's a kindly pot roast. You know, because you can imagine what an unkindly looking pot roast would look like, you know?
It's
really a kindly looking pot roast. But I do that. I'm collecting. And so now I'm collecting a lot of stuff to put in that book. But, you know, it really just doesn't stop. There's a series, a children's series that I want to write, and I'm collecting ideas for that. And then there's parts of, you know, I told you this book was twice as long.
Yeah.
The other half, I love.
Sure.
And everybody loves, you know, it's wonderful. It just couldn't be in this book. It's too long, too much.
Right.
So that, there's a storyline in there that I want to turn into another young adult novel. Uh-huh. So there's a children's series I want to write, a young adult series I want to write, but then there's this one particular novel that that I want to write based on two characters I removed from this book. And I'm actually thinking that what would be great fun is to set that book, that children's book, in this town, Quiet Pond. And so many of these characters would reoccur.
Right.
And that through that children's book, a lot of the answers to the questions that I'm getting from people about what happened in this book
could
be resolved, or you could get some inkling as to what happened because
more clues.
But of course, you'd have to be reading a different genre. You'd have to be reading a children's genre to understand.
The line between adult fiction and young adult fiction is really blurry.
It's blurry. Yeah. It's blurry. And I read, I read a lot of children's literature. I was a teacher.
Yeah.
And I was the Title I coordinator for our public school system. And Title I, I don't know if you know what Title I is.
No, I don't.
Title I is an educational grant that provides money to school systems to close the achievement gap between minority children and white children and poor children and middle-class children. It's an educational grant, and it's a huge, huge education grant that's been in place for more than 40 years now, instituted by Lyndon Johnson. And I ran that grant because, you know, really that's from a reading teacher, right?
Uh-huh.
So
right.
Children's literature has meant a lot to me my whole professional life, and it continues to be.
Uh-huh.
And I read aloud a lot. I do love to read aloud. I'm very comfortable reading aloud, you know.
That's one of the great things about having kids.
It's one of the great things about having things with kids. I read to my kids every night still, and they're 11 and 8 years old. I read to them still every night. And so that line is very blurred because beautiful young adult literature is beautiful literature.
Yeah, it is. That's right.
And you are, as an adult, deeply moved by it. And really the only things that you can find that are substantially different may be the density of the writing, not even the story, because, for example, Harry Potter, very dense story, stories, very dense, complex, very complicated. And, Ink Spell by Cornelia Funke, those are very dense stories, extremely dense. Because kids have tremendous minds, you know, they can really sort all of that out and keep it completely safe and in place, you know, for later retrieval. Yeah. And it's only a question of language, the density of your language, and perhaps the poetry of your language is different as well. When you have, like, for example, I think Marilyn Robinson, I spoke of Marilyn Robinson, Mark Halperin, lines in a row will be poetic. Lines in a row. But when you have a children's novel, often it'll be like some punctuated with a beautifully poetic line, but something that's relatively, I don't want to say simple, but relatively clear, and then punctuated with a poetic line. Although there are beautiful children's novels that are written entirely in poetry.
Yeah.
Karen Hesse, beautiful, beautiful things. Sharon Creech, Love That Dog, which I mentioned to that guy in Marshall who was really sang the song about the dog.
Right.
Said, you got to get this book. anyway, so yeah, I have a lot of ideas. This is a question of just getting to work.
Well, Sujatha, thanks so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. This has
been
great fun. I love this town. This has been a wonderful highlight of.
Well, don't wait till your next book to come back.
Well, you know, maybe I can just hurry up and write the next book.
There you go.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. That's going to be wordplay for this week. I often, you know, say things like this, that if you really want more information about today's show, you should, you know, check naturespoetry.blogspot.com. And I'm going to say that once again because there really is additional information about this. And not only that, when this show goes up on the archive at iBiblio, the permanent wordplay archive, there will be some actual bonus tracks, two more tracks of Sujatha reading from As It Was Written. So it'll be worth checking out. That won't go up right away. It'll go up in about a week when the show goes off the station archive. So anyway, that's something to look forward to. And one of the chapters that Sujatha reads on the one of the bonus tracks is has an adult content advisory, so it's and it's wonderful. Her book, As It Was Written, is published by St. Martin's Press this year, 2010, a little bit earlier, and it's available at Malaprops and various and sundry other bookstores. So, yeah, do check it out.